Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
In less than 20 minutes, the Senate has confirmed the nomination of John Roberts as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court for perhaps the next several decades. We'll have more on the Roberts Court in a moment, but first, also on the Hill, the hammer has come down, or at least temporarily been set aside. Today, for the first time in 10 years, Majority Whip Tom DeLay, who's known as the Hammer, the man revered and reviled for his ability to twist arms and win votes, is not in the Republican leadership ranks. DeLay was forced to step down yesterday after being indicted by a grand jury in Texas on a charge of conspiracy to violate the state's election laws by violating a Texas ban on the use of corporate money for state candidates. DeLay insists he is the victim of a partisan witch hunt and that his move to the sidelines is only temporary.
It is a very bold and aggressive agenda. We are going to stay focused on that agenda. I'm going to help them accomplish that agenda because I'm still a member of Congress.
Republicans are rallying to fill the leadership void. After initially choosing California Congressman David Dreyer, Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert gave in to conservatives who disliked Dreyer's moderate stance. Instead, Hastert chose Representative Roy Blunt from Missouri, a conservative with close ties to the White House. Well, joining us with the mood on the Hill is Chris Saliza. He's reported with WashingtonPost.com, rather. And Chris, how are Republicans feeling about DeLay this morning?
Well, I think we're in sort of the early stages of deciding how they're feeling. You know, this is it didn't come as a total shock to anyone on the Hill. It's certainly something that was rumored and acknowledged as a possibility even by the most loyal Republicans. But the actuality of it happening is a whole another can of worms. Mm-hmm. So we're really right now sort of waiting for what the impact will be. I mean, we have a few practical impacts. Number one, DeLay had to step down as majority leader. Number two, Roy Blunt, a Republican from Missouri, stepped in. But sort of the impact of those moves remains to be seen at this point.
Well, there is a mood issue, I would think. Mm-hmm. Joe Gaylord, who's a longtime Republican consultant, has said that when you couple Iraq, the slow response to Katrina, additional accusations about Senator Bill Frist, others have also thrown in the arrest of former White House budget official David Savavian. Joe Gaylord, again, Republican consultant, says it looks like 10 years is a long time for a party to be in power.
I don't think there's any question that if you call a random Republican, if they didn't have to talk to you with their name attached to it, they would tell you that, you know, great days are not here right now.
But are they closing ranks around DeLay?
You know, I think they are a little bit, but I think that's the initial reaction. I think we really need to wait and see, because the initial thought is paint this with a partisan brush. You know, paint Ronnie Earl, the Travis County district attorney who is responsible for this, paint him as a partisan Democrat and see if that sort of flies with the American public. If it doesn't, and who knows if it will or won't, but if it doesn't, I think that's when you'll really see some folks breaking ranks. But just as one example, Jeb Bradley, a Republican congressman from New Hampshire, returned money that Tom DeLay had given him for his past campaigns today. So you're already seeing a little bit of breaking in the ranks there. A lot of Democrats are calling on Republicans in other states to return money from DeLay, and you know that may be sort of a leading indicator of where the Republicans are in terms of how they're thinking about Tom DeLay.
Well, you mentioned the Democrats, and before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about that. Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi released a brief statement yesterday, but other than that, we had felt that we hadn't heard much from Democrats. Are you?
I think that's a part of a planned strategy. They don't want to make this look political, although, of course, everything is, you know, has a tinge of politics to it. So the goal is to lay low and let this play itself out. It's already a bad enough story for Republicans. Democrats don't feel like they need to, pile on. They don't want to overplay their hand. They don't want to look like they're thrilled that the majority leader is indicted. So what they want to do is just sort of lay low, see how it plays out. But certainly this goes to the argument they've been making for some time, which is that, as you said, Joe Gaylord made the point that 10 years may be too much, and that we now have the Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist from Tennessee under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission for some stock sales, and now we have the Majority Leader indicted. So, both of those things are sort of potent tools that Democrats are certainly going to use in 2006.
Chris Saliza, a reporter with WashingtonPost.com. Chris, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you for taking the time, Robin.
Well, as we said, the U.S. Supreme Court has a new leader. John Roberts has been confirmed by the Senate, becoming at age 50 one of the youngest Supreme Court Chief Justices in this nation's history.
On this vote, the ayes are 78, the nays are 22. The nomination of John G. Roberts, Jr. of Maryland, to be Chief Justice of the United States is confirmed.
Move to reconsider.
Without objection.
Mr. President, I ask that the President be immediately notified of the Senate action. The Senate resumed.
In a sign of the solemnity of the occasion, senators stood at their desks to cast their vote. Republicans were unanimous in their approval, and half of the chamber's Democrats also voted aye, such as Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, who has said he had to take Roberts at his word that he does not have an ideological agenda. But that and who the President will nominate to replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor remains to be seen. Joining us on the line, George Washington University Law Professor Jonathan Turley. Jonathan, welcome as always.
Thank you.
And the Roberts era set to start, and, you know, barring illness or some misfortune, it could last decades. Want to hazard at the starting gate here, and then, you know, 40 years from now we can go get the tape. What's going to be the hallmark?
Well, I honestly believe that the Roberts Court may prove to be the most transformative, at least in modern history, maybe in our history. You know, there are a great number of doctrines, critical doctrines, that currently dangle by one vote. His replacing Rehnquist won't change that vote, but the replacement of Sandra Day O'Connor would. And I think that Roberts will lead a court dramatically to the right, and we're going to see a lot of shifts on those doctrines, and it's going to touch the lives of many Americans. And many of us were surprised by Leahy's comments when he said, you know, I'm going to take him at his word. For those of us who covered the hearings, we didn't hear him say anything. I mean, mm-hmm. So we weren't sure what Leahy heard. I mean, Roberts literally began and finished that hearing without a single substantive statement as to his views.
And conservatives and liberals have raised questions about that. But you mentioned, you know, the Sandra Day O'Connor position. And speculation is that President Bush may make his nomination to replace Justice O'Connor as soon as tomorrow. First of all, have you heard that? And do you think that that's imminent?
Well, we're hearing that, but, you know, I think the best money would be on Monday. Karl Rove is too good of a Beltway player to make a mistake like that. There's no reason to release the name on Friday and let them torch the nominee through the weekend. By waiting till Monday, you avoid the weekend shows. You keep the speculation alive. And in my view, it would be a tactical mistake. And I got to tell you, so far the White House in this Roberts thing has really played an almost unprecedentedly perfect campaign. Mm. So my bet would be on Monday.
Well, let's stay with that nomination for a minute. We want to take a look at what's on the court's docket. But before we do, a new name, Harriet Myers, has been circulating lately as a possible nominee. Who is she?
Well, Harriet Myers has perhaps the most important credential that a potential nominee can have, and that is she's a friend of George W. Bush. You know, when he faces these types of nominations, Bush tends to run home. He tends to go to people he knows that he likes and trusts. She was his personal attorney in Texas. She joined him at the White House in a critical secretary role in terms of what the president actually saw. And then she followed Gonzalez as White House counsel. Now, having said all that, I don't know of anyone that would mention Harriet Myers as a serious candidate for the Supreme Court based on credentials. In that sense, she actually does look a lot like Sandra Day O'Connor, because O'Connor basically had a political background. Myers has a largely political background, but in neither case would you associate them with the idea of a Supreme Court position.
Right, and Harriet Myers has not been a judge. She has no record on the bench. The chair of PepsiCo, Larry Thompson, is also said to be a contender.
He is. Now, he is a known item to the administration. He worked with Attorney General John Ashcroft. He's an African-American. He's young. And he has been on the short list for some time. I think there is a lot of pressure to put another woman on the court with the departure of Sandra Day O'Connor. It helps them politically. If the senators are going to have to try to go after this nominee. But, you know, the Democratic ranks are in such disorder and, frankly, incoherent disorder that I'm not too sure they're going to get the traction they need. If the White House appoints a Roberts clone, how is someone like Leahy going to say, look, I accepted the first nominee refusing to answer any questions, but I'm not going to accept that from you?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of institutional ground that the Democrats gave away this time.
Well, that lies ahead of us, as does this court's docket. The current Supreme Court is going to be going into session. They've been saying what their cases are going to be that they're going to take. So let's start on those. And remind us, first of all, why is reality TV star, formerly famous for being the young wife to a very old man, and also someone who's got fame recently for losing a lot of weight, Anna Nicole Smith, why is she on the docket?
Doesn't seem quite historic, eh?
Well,
she actually is on the docket for perhaps the most boring possible legal issue, and it goes to the jurisdiction of the federal courts to look at these types of questions when there is a state case pending. So the irony is that you've got this incredibly, sensational figure, and she's bringing to the court perhaps the world's most boring legal question.
Can you tell, what is it again? What?
It's simply a question of whether federal courts can hear her type of probate dispute when there's an act of probate going on in the state courts. It's a purely jurisdictional question.
What's her dispute?
Well, the dispute is whether, in fact, the federal court could grant relief. This case in probate has gone back and forth in terms of a court ruling for her and then having a court rule against her, and it became a big jurisdictional question. But for those people that will want to follow this closely because they love the reality show, if you read the briefs, it's a cure to insomnia.
Well, but we're going to get to the other issues, and there are very serious ones, but will she actually be in the Supreme Court?
Well, she might, just for purely publicity, but it's not like you sit at the table with your lawyer. She could, she'd probably be given a seat in the chambers.
But still, that's going to draw a lot of people paying attention to the Supreme Court who hadn't previously. Well, there are a lot of other courses. The first major case the court will hear next Wednesday focuses on the state of Oregon's 10-year-old voter-approved assisted suicide law. Jonathan, we're heading into a break, but just remind us, what is the Justice Department arguing in this case, then we'll pick it up on the other side.
The Justice Department is arguing first that the federal government can effectively bar this type of legislation and can pursue criminally or civilly people who engage in assisted suicide.
And how might the court rule in this?
Well, this will be an enormous test because it not only goes to the life issues, but more importantly, it goes to the federalism issue. What is the inherent authority of the state vis-a-vis the federal government? And so Roberts will have a natural sort of conflict on this one. He tends to have a view, I think, that is pro-life, but he supposedly also is pro-states' rights. So it's going to be a very interesting opinion in terms of seeing how Roberts deals with such conflicts.
And also along the way, we're all going to be reminded of the many cases people who have used this assisted law in Oregon. People in Oregon are familiar with these stories, but we haven't heard them in a while. We'll be hearing those again. Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. He'll be back with us when we return after a brief break. We'll talk about some of the other cases on the docket and also raise the question, what happens if Sandra Day O'Connor is replaced midterm? Much more ahead. Here and now. Stay with us. Continuing our conversation about what's on the docket for the new Roberts Supreme Court. Back with us, George Washington University Law Professor Jonathan Turley. And Jonathan, the new Supreme Court's docket is already full. We're going to get more to it. But what happens to these cases if the current court with Sandra Day O'Connor, is changed, if there is a replacement for her and she's already involved in cases? What happens?
Well, that's a real logistical nightmare because you cannot count a justice's vote unless that justice is on the court when the opinion is released. So if O'Connor votes on a case and then leaves the court, her vote would have to be negated. Now, what that means is that the court could require re-argument of some of these cases, or it could conceivably just negate her vote and go forward with an eight justice vote. So that's one of the reasons that it would be better to get someone on the court as early as possible.
Well, we'll have to wait and see what happens there. But let's go through the cases we know are on the court. There are three abortion cases. Let's start with those. The New Hampshire Attorney General versus Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. Now, that focuses on whether there's enough of a health exception in a state law that requires parental notification for a teenager who wants an abortion.
That's right. Yeah. And this is a very important case because the question of not just life but the health of a mother touches on a great number of different issues that may come before the court. And this will be the first test in terms of John Roberts. I personally have been saying for some time that I expect that Roberts will vote on these cases with the hard right of the court.
But what's at the heart of it, whether or not a teenager can have an abortion without her parents knowing, if there's the health of the teenager a concern?
That's right. That the Supreme Court has left a bit of a mess when it comes to the right of states to require either parental notification or parental consent. It is expected that this term the court's going to clarify that in establishing the parental rights, not just the minor's rights. And this New Orleans New Hampshire statute is going to be critical in terms of when states can require so-called parental notifications, that is to notify parents when minors are seeking an abortion.
Well, the health exception also at the heart of the federal law banning so-called partial birth abortions, that never took effect. The Supreme Court this week agreed to hear the president's appeal. Is he going to try to reinstate it?
Yeah, I think it's very telling. This is a big issue for the administration. They believe it's a winning political issue. Even people who are normally pro-choice go the other way when it comes to partial birth abortion. It's something that Roberts, in my view, can be expected to vote with the administration on. And so you could have the Supreme Court effectively overturn its earlier ruling in a Nebraska case that struck down a partial birth abortion law. A law that effectively banned the use of it. And at the heart of that issue, once again, was to what extent those laws have to consider not just the life but the health of the mother. Legislators have argued that the health of the mother is already included in the laws and that the Supreme Court's imposing a much higher standard than the Constitution would impose.
Mm. Operation Rescue versus the National Organization for Women. This is the case that focuses on whether racketeering laws can be used against abortion protesters. This has to do with crossing state lines for protests?
Right, and this is a case. This is a case that the Supreme Court has dealt with repeatedly, and it deals with when you can use things like racketeering laws against anti-abortion protesters. There has been a great hue and cry that the use of racketeering laws against groups like Operation Rescue raises significant First Amendment questions as well as the federal jurisdiction questions. I mean, the racketeering law was designed to combat mobsters. Since then, it has been expanded dramatically. But what Operation Rescue has argued is that the use of these types of laws against its organizations effectively chill speech and extends RICO far beyond what it was intended to do.
Mm. Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, helping us to look at the new Supreme Court, new docket. And we know, Jonathan, the courts are also going to hear arguments about military recruiting on college campuses. They agreed this week to take up campaign finance law. But in the couple minutes we have, I wanted to ask you, you had mentioned that there were some cases that had a one-vote difference that were going to be very tight. Which ones are those?
Well, we have a great number of cases that currently hang by single vote, and those include things like affirmative action, the famous Grutter decision a couple years ago, which upheld the affirmative action program of selecting students for the Michigan Law School. That's one vote that's hanging the difference there. In environmental cases, abortion cases like partial birth abortion hang by a single vote that I think very well could be changed by the next nominee. There are literally dozens. It is a harbor crowded with 5-4 decisions. And the Roberts and the next nominee are something of live torpedoes in that harbor. Anywhere they go, they're likely to hit a major doctrine that is dangling by a single vote that is now going to be off the court. That's Sandra Day O'Connor's vote.
Mm. So, Jonathan Turley, a whole new era begins. Your thoughts as it starts?
I think that the Roberts Court, when we look back in 40 years, will be considered perhaps the most influential court in our history. And I think for people like Leahy and others, there may be some questions raised in the short term. In this very year, you could see that seismic shift, and there will be people who come back and say, you know, did you really, you know, fight hard enough? And should you have required for him to be more forthcoming?
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. Again, John Roberts was confirmed today by the Senate in just a little over 15 minutes. He will be sworn in this afternoon as the new Supreme Court Justice of the United States. Jonathan Turley, thanks for speaking with us about the new court.
My great pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from a new public relations offensive has just been launched, and it may be a tough sell. Al-Qaeda has apparently started up its first newscast. Voice of the Caliphate premiered this week on an Islamic website where militants usually post their statements.
عليه أن يعرف أنه من المتعذر تخيل أمريكا من دون نيو أورلينز.
Catch the words America, New Orleans, Louisiana. Experts say the brief newscast appears to be genuine, although it could be produced by anyone with a video camera. In it, a masked anchorman sitting beside a Quran and a rifle mounted on a tripod presents what he says will be weekly news. In this initial newscast we just heard, the anchorman discusses Israel's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and says, quote, "The whole Muslim world was filled with joy about the devastation caused by Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans." Well, as Al-Qaeda tries to get its message out, Karen Hughes, the new Undersecretary of State in the U.S., is also on a PR offensive for the U.S. in the Middle East and Turkey. It's a listening tour, and Karen Hughes is getting an earful. In Istanbul, women blasted Hughes over the war in Iraq. Her response, women in Iraq are better off now than they were under Saddam Hussein. Well, for more reaction to the Hughes trip, we turn to journalist Mona El-Tahawi. She writes a weekly column for the Arab language daily paper Arshak Al-Wasat. And Mona, despite what Karen Hughes says, many women have told us on this program that Iraqi women were better off under Saddam Hussein than after his fall in many ways. But tell us more about what these Turkish women said to Karen Hughes.
I think their main message to Karen Hughes was that regardless of any positive impact that the U.S. presence could have had in Iraq, the overwhelming violence and the bloody headlines that we hear of every day have overshadowed all that positive impact, and that people in the region are very upset with what's happening in Iraq these days.
Well, and these were Turkish women, and Turkey has been very nervous about the Kurds across the border. So the politics might have played into it as well.
The politics absolutely played into it. And interestingly enough, one of the women mentioned to Karen Hughes that they were worried about a Kurdish group that goes by the acronym PKK and demanded that the U.S. condemn them as a terrorist organization, to which Karen Hughes said the United States had indeed labeled it a terrorist organization. And then Hughes turned to her and said it was ironic that Turkish women in the same breath were condemning the U.S. Action in Iraq, which the Bush administration says is fight terrorism, and yet at the same time Turkey wants American support to fight what it calls terrorism from Kurdish groups. So she walked into a minefield of irony and contradictions during her trip in the Middle East.
And what are people saying about about her tone? I mean, Karen Hughes has always been the tough woman standing behind and alongside President Bush for his entire career almost. How, you know, it was seen as a coup when she was hired for this job. How is what's the rating been on her response to these questions?
You know, before she even set foot in the Middle East, people were already saying in columns and through cartoons in the newspapers here that there's basically nothing she can do to stem this tide of anti-Americanism that is sweeping the region. Basically, a leading columnist with the newspaper that I write a column for, who's known to be a liberal and to be quite pro-American, I mean, he's by no means anti-American, he wrote a column about Karen Hughes in which he basically said, even if the Bush administration were suddenly to become the best cleaning firm in the world, there's nothing they could do to clean up their image in the Arab world. And another newspaper in the Gulf ran a cartoon at the start of her trip in which President Bush was portrayed as sitting in front of a mirror and applying a heavy layer of makeup. And he turns to Karen Hughes and he says, could you give me more makeup and a strong perfume? You know, the meaning being that it doesn't matter how much makeup you layer on, America is still considered to be quite ugly in this part of the world.
She ran into some of these problems in Saudi Arabia as well, where she ran into a huge cultural disconnect. She brought up the Saudi ban on women drivers and gave that as an example of something that Arab women must want to be able to drive. It's a freedom that American women enjoy. But what was the response there?
I think she was quite taken aback when many women in the audience, and all educated and professional, stood up and said, we're happy with our lifestyle, we embrace these traditions, and don't think that we all want to live like Americans. So I don't think she was expecting this reaction, but at the same time, I'd like to add that some women in the audience did appreciate that she brought up these issues, and a good Saudi female friend of mine pointed out that it was basically kind of a natural reaction, kind of defensive reaction to being criticized by America.
Does that same theory apply to her references to anti-Christian and anti-Jewish documents which have been found in mosques in the U.S.? This is something that apparently the U.S. has spoken to Saudi Arabia about privately behind closed doors, but she brought it up publicly.
That also applies where Saudis immediately go into this kind of defensive mode. And the quickest way that they use to defend themselves against this criticism is to say, well, you also need to stem the tide of kind of ugly stereotyping of Saudis in your country, in the United States, that portray Saudi men as being terrorists and portray Saudi women as being oppressed and shrouded in black from head to toe. So you basically have this disconnect applies on almost every level. And if Karen Hughes had described this tour as a listening tour, it turned into basically the dialogue of the deaf, where neither side accepts to listen to each other. And I think that she's going home quite disappointed because from the media coverage that I've been following here, the message does not seem to have gone across well.
But Mona El-Tahawi, is it a necessary start? I mean, is there a sense that it had to start somewhere, even if it's a rough start?
I think absolutely that it had to start somewhere because both sides, quite frankly, need each other. America, the United States, needs the support of the Arab world in helping it in Iraq. And quite frankly, the Arab world definitely needs the United States to pressure the dictators of the Arab world to open up politically and to allow a greater, more vibrant political atmosphere.
Mona El-Tahawi writes for the Arab language daily Al-Sharq Al-Awsat. She's speaking to us from Cairo on Karen Hughes' visit to the region. Mona, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And we've just received this news that is sure to make Karen Hughes' job even harder. A judge has just ruled that additional pictures of detainee abuse at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison must be released despite U.S. government claims that they could damage America's image. Well, still to come, how does a Ukrainian punk rocker land a major movie role? We'll talk to Eugene Hutz about being the star of Everything is Illuminated and the frontman for the punk rock band Gogol Bordello. You're listening to Here and Now. The head of the National Trust for Historic Preservation has said that the damage from Hurricane Katrina has the potential of being one of the largest cultural disasters in this country's history. In one seven-mile span of historic homes in Mississippi, only one stands. Well, joining us on the line now, Peter Brink of the National Trust. And Mr. Brink, you've toured New Orleans. Let's start there with your three-part plan to help owners restore those damaged buildings.
One is to get the message out that many can be saved. We've just completed a handout that gives advice to homeowners and others on the steps they can take to clean out the moisture, avoid the molds and fungi that you hear about. Secondly, we're working now on shipping tarps, because one of the dangers is that a lot of homes didn't suffer flooding, but they have roof damage or trees that fell on houses, and you need to do temporary repair, i.e. tarps, so that as we get more rains, that rain doesn't come through the structures and cause more damage. We have in Congress being considered a private grant program. The current public monies largely go for addressing public health and infrastructure and levees.
And buildings that are about to, you know, collapse or have collapsed.
If they're a threat to public health or safety. But we're suggesting, proposing at least $60 million from Congress that would be grants for private homeowners to help them make their way towards rehabilitation and saving this important architectural heritage.
Before we leave the New Orleans area, and I want to make sure we look at Mississippi, as you looked at these homes, even though, as you said, many of them could be saved, I'm looking at pictures, and we'll have pictures on our website. For instance, one of the African-American museum in the Treme neighborhood.
Yeah,
just
went by there.
Oh, trees felled, walls down.
The feeling is sadness, but there are a couple buildings that make up the African-American museum in Treme. We were there with one of the board members, and their feeling is that most of those buildings can be saved.
Mm-hmm. But then we look over at Mississippi. The devastation there is amazing.
Right along the coast, it's almost total devastation. And the report that we get is that the downtowns of Passe Christiane and Bay St. Louis are basically gone.
Well, take a second and remind us of the Mississippi landmarks that might be gone. I mean, some people might be familiar, for instance, with Grass Lawn. That was a mansion that was built in the early 1800s, and there was apparently a Frank Lloyd Wright home.
The one that stands out in my mind is Jefferson Davis's house, which is right in Biloxi near mm-hmm. the water, Beauvoir. And that, we know, it is savable, and it's going to cost a huge amount of money. Local estimates run up to $25 million. On the other hand, this is a major landmark in Mississippi.
So, sure.
But we're also being told that in Gulfport and Biloxi, there's damage, but there are a lot of buildings there that can be saved to form the nucleus for a revived downtown.
Peter Brink is the Senior Vice President of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and I know that you and other officials are worried that in the haste to rebuild, you know, bulldozers might aim at the wrong house.
Yes, our message continually is that often houses that have had disasters look worse than they are, and you need qualified people, experts, preservation architects, others, to come in and do an assessment and do that before saying, well, this looks terrible, we're going to take it down.
For people listening who are not, you know, living in the area now but have been there, can you just, what comes to mind to you that you saw damaged in New Orleans that's going to resonate with people who go there? I'm thinking of a picture I saw of the Commander's Palace restaurant, which is familiar to many. That
yes,
was damaged.
Yes, I ate there years ago. It looked like part of the facade was ripped off. I have no doubt that the Commander's Palace and many, many of the other great restaurants and jazz places and neighborhoods will come back. We want to avoid, as people who love New Orleans, having just a showplace of a couple neighborhoods, you know, the Vicuray and the Garden mm-hmm. District, instead of a large, culturally rich, wonderful city.
Peter Brink, Senior Vice President of the National Trust, he's speaking to us about the historic homes and buildings affected by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. For more information and to see those pictures that we mentioned on our website, you can go there, here-now.org. Mr. Brink, thanks very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And stay with much or more ahead, including the band Gogo Bordello. That's coming up, Here and Now. If you read Jonathan Safran Foer's smash bestseller, Everything is Illuminated, you were introduced to one of the great characters of fiction, Alex, the wacky Ukrainian interpreter. And you may be wondering, how are they going to capture that guy on film in the movie currently opening nationwide? Well, they hired a wacky Ukrainian punk rocker named Eugene Hutz. Eugene was born in 1972 in Ukraine. He fled with his family when Chernobyl blew, moving through refugee camps as his nomadic gypsy ancestors once did. As a kid in the Soviet Union, he saw Sonic Youth and knew that someday he would live in New York and play punk rock. Once he arrived there, he also became a trend-setting fashion model and now, as we said, an actor. We caught up with Eugene Hutz when he was touring with his band Go-Go Bordello, quite possibly the only international gypsy-slash-punk-rock band out there, and we talked to him about his career in music and now film.
Dogs were barking, guests were parking, and my wedding was about to start. Dogs were barking, monkeys clapping, then I got up on table and I said, I meet you 10:45 on the Broadway Canal.
What did punk mean to you? I said you saw Sonic Youth when you were in Ukraine.
Yeah, back when they were in their prime, yes.
And when you fled Ukraine, in fact, the first thing you tried to decide was how many of my bootleg albums can I get out, you know, before the Chernobyl wave comes over me. I mean, this has obviously been important to you. What did punk mean to you?
It meant liberation and change, as it had meant that to many, many people across many, many countries. It's the only thing it can mean. It's basically getting up and doing something out for yourself despite all this garbage that system feeds to you since you're born. Mm. And the thing is that it was even double-powered by the fact that it was in perestroika time, where in the late 80s, the whole country was embraced in a social change and reformation. Whether people liked it or not, the change was on the corner.
And what you're adding to it now is this gypsy flavor. You have gypsy ancestors. What does that music say to you?
I think that music is particularly of Russian and Ukrainian Roma, which is Roma, which is correct word for the gypsy, mm-hmm. is more of a...
By the way, I have to ask, are you offended if I say gypsy? Is that offensive?
No.
Okay.
Well, it's been so... You know, I'd rather have that word out there so people at least start getting interested in what it actually is, then educate them about actual words, then just say Roma and then have people thinking that it means Italian or
right.
or Romanian, you know.
Yeah, right.
So since it's so widely accepted, I have to kind of work with that.
Okay.
But challenge that right after the reference, you know.
Well, what does it mean to you, Roma, gypsy?
I think most of all it's just kind of unifying factor for issues that concern me the most, which is music and human rights. The whole thing about Roma culture is that it's been so derogatory treated for so many centuries that it became a symbolic thing for violation of human rights, which just goes on left and right. And I just find it to be an extremely urgent issue.
In most of your songs, you express some sort of observation about some facet of human life. We're going to hear Avenue B. What's this about?
That song was kind of a result of this Russian party in New York that where so many people get so fired up discussing what Russian identity really is. And some of them claiming that Russian identity basically doesn't even exist, you know, because you can't identify something that takes over such a large territory. Mm. If you think about, like, tough, pushy guys, you know, who drink a lot and party, that's not even necessarily really Russian. But it's all about challenging what really stereotypes and just really making sure that people still go more for international mentality than anything, that they inherited with propaganda as far as national factors go.
Rather than stereotyping.
Yeah, I mean, this band is so international. Mm-hmm. It's a big anti-nationalistic statement.
Well, you and five of your international bandmates have brought your instruments here to our studios. They range from an accordion and a violin to your guitar, Eugene. Let's hear Avenue B from Go-Go Bordello.
Маркс только пойдет, а пошли.
That was the band Go Go Bordello playing Avenue B off their new CD. And Eugene, I can't let you go without asking about your film experience. You know, people have been coming to the studio and seeing you, and they're like, in New York, he's a superstar. I mean, I remember the articles about your fashion model experience, right?
Uh-huh.
When you have this mustache that spans your whole face there.
Well, it's the usual, you know. I've had it for 7 years.
I know, but everyone thought it was this big fashion statement.
Well, that describes how foolish the fashion business is, because, you know, it's simply how my whole family looks, and it's how my uncle looks and my father looks, and it was hilarious. We were cracking up with the whole family.
From there, you go to talk to the director of the film version of Jonathan Safran Foer's bestseller, Everything is Illuminated.
Uh-huh.
You talk to him about perhaps doing some music, and the next thing you know, you are cast as perhaps one of the great characters in literature in a long time, Alex, the Ukrainian.
He's definitely a fun character, yes.
Alex, for those who hadn't read the book, he's a very self-assured interpreter who just mangles the English language.
Yes.
How do you feel about him?
Well, I love mangling English myself. and now that I'm speaking it pretty much fluently, I'm kind of starting to miss times when I was writing God knows what and getting up on stage and actually not even knowing what the hell I'm really singing. So I'm kind of like due to move on to some other language as far as that treat goes.
You could probably...
Maybe Spanish will be my next
stop. So you can continue to mangle.
Well, another thing is that when I was growing up in Ukraine, I was surrounded by characters like that. I mean, it's anti-biographical character for me, and that's what I loved about it, because on stage... And with Gogol Bordello, I control my whole work. And so here I was working with control from somewhere else too, which is, you know, a challenge I kind of already was ready for.
Eugene Hutz with his band Gogol Bordello have been visiting us in the studio. It's a pleasure to meet you, and we really look forward to more from you.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me and putting up with us.
For more information on Gogol Bordello, go to our website, here-now.org.
It's the underdog world tonight.
And Lee Schreiber's film version of Jonathan Safran Foer's Everything is Illuminated, featuring Eugene Hutz as the Ukrainian interpreter, is currently opening nationwide. As they say, check your listings. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin.